from 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm Evan Kleinman, and this is Good Food. Today, using food to keep our brain sharp. The father of California cuisine, Jonathan Waxman, is here. We'll go out for Italian with Pulitzer Prize winner Jonathan Gold, plus using the bounty of our backyards to feed the hungry. And Assyrian food, what that is and how it tastes. But first, let's check in with Laura Avery to see what's in season in Southern California this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're so excited that the cherries are coming back to the market now, and we're devouring bags and bags of fresh cherries. Akasha Richmond, however, is going to share a recipe with us. She's here shopping, as she always does. She's telling us that she can make an adult or a grown-up maraschino cherry.
I make these maraschino cherries also because I have cherries for a while because the season's so short. It's not that long. And so, these keep for a few months. So I do them for my bartender at our bar at Akasha. And you make like a kind of a simple syrup, water, and sugar. You could even use agave, and you add a couple cinnamon sticks, maybe a vanilla bean. You could add star anise if you wanted to. You could even put ginger in there. You could put anything you want. Bring that mixture to a simmer. Let it cook maybe 5 minutes so you get the flavor of the cinnamon and the vanilla. And then you add the fresh cherries. You wash them. Leave the stem on. Put them in and just let it cook for a couple minutes. You don't want to overcook the cherry, but you want to cook it enough that it can stay preserved in that syrup. And then you just cool it down. And it's a great garnish for a drink, but then you have that syrup too. So she puts we do a drink called the Whiskey Summer. And she puts, I think it's a bourbon, lemon, the cherry. Oh, there's a little lemon in the cherry. You can put a little lemon in there too.
So simple syrup, it's basically a mixture of just plain sugar, or you said agave, and water.
Right.
Proportions are what?
I think it's 1-to-1, like okay. 2 cups water, 2 cups sugar. But it's delicious. And then, of course, you can use that syrup for a million things, too. You could put that syrup into an iced tea. And you can make those cherries with brandy or without brandy. You can also add a little brandy there to bring out the flavor, the brandy and the cherry. Oh, they're delicious.
Oh, wait a minute. So do you put the brandy in the hot simple syrup? At what point do you add the brandy?
I add it so it cooks in there, so it's not, just in there. But you could do it either way. So they're a little spiked. And, you can play around with it. You could add a lot of brandy. You could add a little brandy. It's delicious.
And then once you've made this, you cool it. You keep it in jars in the fridge?
You keep it in jars in the fridge. Mm-hmm. Now, you could can them, heat seal them in the jars, and then you could keep it out of the fridge. But, that's a whole that we go through so many, and I'm sure you will too, that you don't need to can them and put them up. But you could.
Do you have to pit them or not?
I don't pit them because it's just too much to pit all those cherries. Mm-hmm. But you could pit them.
And how long do you cook them all together? I mean, from beginning, you cook the simple syrup, you put the cherries in. How long do they have to cook?
Just a few minutes. You just bring it back up to a simmer and maybe cook it for 2 or 3 minutes. You don't want to cook them that long because if you overcook them, they'll turn into mush and they will actually start disintegrating and falling right off of the pit and the whole thing.
Do you have to call them maraschino cherries? Can we come up with a better name?
I don't call them maraschino. Oh. I call them brandied cherries.
Okay.
I have a pet peeve against maraschino cherries because of the red dye.
And for the under 21 crowd, we can call it spiced cherries.
Spiced cherries. Yeah. And you don't have to put the brandy in.
Yeah.
I mean, if you wanted to make these at home and put them in ginger ale for your kids and make a Shirley Temple.
Sounds
delicious,
so good.
Right?
All right, Akasha. Well, that sounds fabulous. The cocktails sound good and the cherries themselves sound even better. So thanks so much for sharing that.
Thank you.
During the month of May, we really enjoy all the fresh produce at the market. We also equally enjoy the wonderful shellfish that's brought in from Carlsbad Aqua Farm. Christophe Hapillon is the man who comes to the Wednesday market every week, who sets up a beautiful oyster bar right at the stand here for Carlsbad Aqua Farm. And Christophe, there is an old wives' tale that tells people that they should not eat shellfish in a month that does not contain an R. And here we are in May. Can you tell us if you've had any customers come up and ask you that same thing and ask if it's okay to buy oysters in May?
Yes, well, there's an old story from the antiquity. The Romans were very fond of oyster. So 2,000 years ago, what's happened in Europe, we've got a different species of oyster. They are live-bearing. So all the spat, the larva of the oyster, are inside. So therefore, when you eat an oyster, you're going to have this grainy kind of scent inside. They were basically holding and carrying those oysters from Brittany to Rome. So it's about 3 weeks by, like a horse. So in the summer, it was impossible to do. In the winter, it was possible. Therefore, we do have a season where they are kind of like milky, but it's a very short season. It's basically going from about 3 weeks in August. The rest of the time, they are still very lean and plump, like all the time the oyster from Carlsbad.
It's when they breed and they create that the egg mass inside, and that's what in August would prevent you from bringing them in. Because yes. What happens then? Then they expel those eggs, and then you harvest those to then grow more oysters? What happens to that?
Well, the spat is a larva, so it's already go from the eggs to something with a shell. Oh. The spat is something that's already stick to the bottom. The eggs is like the planktonic stage. It's a plankton, so it's carrying by the current. The reproduction is the season, basically the water temperature and the moon cycle trigger the spawning. It's a synchronization. But yes, when they get like milky, it's basically the gonad that's mm-hmm. gonna be released in the water and create the baby oyster that we eat. About 18 to 23 months after. So that's about the time it takes to grow an oyster to the market size.
Really? 1.5 to 2 years to grow an oyster. Yeah.
Yep.
So what kind of oysters have you got here today?
Today we got the full selection of oyster from Carlsbad. We've got the blondes, the lunas, and the del sol. So the luna, it's a briny oyster, really, that's the youngest one, very briny. Then the blonde is something a little bit more creamier, more mature. And then we got the del sol. The del sol, it's an oyster that we put through a process of maturation for about 3 days in less salty water. All those oysters go through a three-day depuration tank to make sure that it's a spa treatment, to make sure that they are perfect, and that's why they taste so fresh.
And so fresh. When you bring them up here, you harvested them like yesterday.
Absolutely. They just came up to the water 24 hours prior. So you cannot beat that.
You can't beat that, no. Okay. And you also sell in-season clams and mussels.
Yes, we do. Mussels all year round, actually. And the clams program is going to be operational. We're going to get the clams basically by somewhere around November or December.
Okay.
So they are still growing right now. The season, as everybody knows, the weather has been very cold this year. So we're lagging behind for this reason. But they will come.
They will come. Just like the fruit. The fruit is 2 weeks late because we've had some cold weather, too. So even the clams feel it, huh?
Absolutely. We are farmer from the sea, but we're still farmer.
That's exactly right. All right, Christoph, well, this is wonderful. And you can also come to your booth and just have a little stand-up oyster bar action right here if you can't wait to take them home. Okay, Christoph, well, thank you so much. We appreciate the delicious oysters. Thanks again.
Thank you for your time.
That was Christoph Hapillon, and he is the very knowledgeable oyster producer, and he's at the booth every week here Wednesday, and we'll shuck an oyster for you to enjoy while you're standing right here. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
A recipe for Akasha's grown-up maraschino cherries is on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. Also on the blog, check out a really fun video series where we ask LA's top chefs 5 questions. Find out what ingredient Walter Mansky can't live without or what Dan Matron would be doing if he wasn't a chef. The answers will surprise you. Watch the videos on our blog or on our YouTube channel.
Life is just a bowl of cherries. Don't take it serious. Life's too mysterious. You work, you save, you worry so, but you can't take your dough when you go, go, go.
Dr. Andrew Weil is a world-renowned leader and pioneer in the field of integrative medicine. It's a healing-oriented approach to healthcare, which encompasses body, mind, and spirits. Dr. Weil's been at the forefront of both research and advice regarding how different foods can affect our well-being. I guess let's talk first about our brains. You know, a lot of us are reaching that age where we feel like our brains are slipping out of our ears. And we'd like to hold on to as much focus, acuity as we possibly can. From a dietary standpoint, what do you think are some of the best things we can do?
The first is to make sure you've got adequate daily intake of omega-3 fatty acids. Absolutely vital for brain health. And the dietary sources of these are few. It's mainly oily fish. And fish is a big concern today. And one of the best sources are sardines. These are little vegetarian fish. They're in great abundance. And especially now that we've eliminated some of the big predator fish, there's lots of sardines around. If you've never had grilled fresh sardines, they're fabulous. But I like to just mash up canned sardines in olive oil, drain the oil with mustard and onion and lemon, and that's a great lunch for me. So omega-3 is vital. That's first.
The concern about bioaccumulation of toxins in fish, mercury, et cetera, on like a sardine, is that something we need to be overly concerned about?
No, because sardines are little fish. They're eating low on the food chain. The bigger the fish, the more carnivorous. The more time it spends in coastal waters, the more worry. The Monterey Aquarium puts out a good wallet card that's a guide to, as does the Audubon Society, which are a guide to fish, both from a point of view of toxicity and sustainability. Sardines are good.
So how many times a week do you think we should be eating?
I think you should eat fish, try to eat oily fish 2 to 3 times a week. And I also recommend that people take supplemental fish oil, 2 to 4 grams a day. The deficiency of omega-3s is probably the most widespread dietary deficiency in our population. It hugely impacts brain health.
How do we know the quality of fish oil we're getting is a good one and not made from a bunch of mercury?
Right. All good fish oils today say that they're molecularly distilled, which means that they're free of contaminants. And there are many good brands out there.
And do we get that sort of famous fishy burp after we take them?
If you take fish oil on a full stomach at the end of a meal, you're less likely to get that. And if you put capsules of fish oil in the freezer and take them right out of the freezer, that also helps.
We got some questions from our listeners on our Facebook page, and a couple of them were about inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be a big medical buzzword these days. What is it and how does it affect us?
We all know inflammation on the surface of the body. It's local redness, heat, swelling, and pain. Inflammation is actually the cornerstone of the body's healing response. It's how the body gets more nourishment and more immune activity to an area that's injured or under attack. But inflammation is so powerful and so potentially destructive that it's important that it stays where it's supposed to stay and end when it's supposed to end. If inflammation serves no purpose, or if it extends beyond its boundaries of time and space, then it becomes productive of disease. And there is growing scientific evidence that chronic, low-level, imperceptible inflammation throughout the body is the root cause of all the big categories of degenerative disease, especially what we call the age-related diseases, cardiovascular disease, cancer, Alzheimer's disease, and other neurodegenerative diseases. So the good news about that is if all these diseases have a common origin, then there's a common solution to them. Most people in our population go through life in a pro-inflammatory state for various reasons, but diet is a huge factor. And anything you can do to lead an anti-inflammatory lifestyle and eat an anti-inflammatory diet, you're way ahead of the game.
Is there one type of food more than any other that sort of perpetuates inflammation?
Refined, processed, and manufactured food. It's that simple. And if I could summarize everything I know about nutrition in one sentence, it's to stop eating refined, processed, and manufactured food. It's everything in the middles of supermarkets. It's everything in convenience stores. It's all the snack foods. This is what's driving inflammation. It's what's driving the obesity epidemic, the epidemic of diabetes that's following that.
Where do carbohydrates fit into that?
Yeah, carbohydrates are really key. And the way that we have transformed carbohydrate foods in the past 50 years is probably the most dramatic thing we've done and bad thing that we've done to the diet. There's a huge difference between a whole grain or a grain that's cracked into a few pieces and a grain that has been milled into a superfine dust, into flour. Whether or not there's some bran present or germ present, flour is flour. And it is the starch has a huge surface area, so digestive enzymes can rapidly convert it to blood sugar. And this is the key thing, is how fast carbohydrate foods raise blood sugar. And those that raise it fast in genetically susceptible people, which is many of us, promote obesity, insulin resistance, what we call metabolic syndrome, and eventually type 2 diabetes. So carbohydrates are key, and this is a big area of misunderstanding. If I ask the average American to name a whole grain food, the usual answer I get is whole wheat bread. No, whole wheat bread is not whole grain food. It's basically colored white bread. You know, it's the same fine powdered starch with a huge surface area that rapidly converts to blood sugar. Fortunately, pasta is in a separate category.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Why is that?
If it's cooked al dente, especially, and not eaten in huge quantities, it has less of an impact on blood sugar than most bread.
If one knows one is going to indulge, can one make up in one's diet from eating more vegetables?
Well, this is, you know, an interesting thing is the glycemic load is of a meal is the average of all the carbohydrate foods in it. So, for example, if you want to eat a waffle, which has a high glycemic load, if you cover it with a lot of blueberries, which have low glycemic load, that pulls the glycemic load of the dish down to a moderate zone. So that's one strategy you can do. Another is that if you eat acid with foods, lemon juice, vinegar, that slows stomach emptying, which also blunts the blood sugar response. Fat slows stomach emptying. You know, and that's why an oatmeal cookie has a lower glycemic load than a bowl of oatmeal, for example.
I've been talking with Dr. Andrew Weil, a pioneer in the field of integrative medicine. Next week on Good Food, Part 2 of my conversation with Dr. Weil, we'll talk about meat, dairy, the raw food diet, and more. We taped that interview in our studios here at KCRW. Dr. Weil was in town for the opening of True Food Kitchen, now open at Santa Monica Place. The entire menu is based on Dr. Weil's anti-inflammatory diet and food pyramid. When Good Food returns, Jonathan Gold is here with a restaurant for us to try, plus a look inside El Bulli. You're listening to 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. I'll be right back. Welcome back to Good Food. I'm your host, Devin Kleiman. It's that time on Saturday morning when we get a taste of something fabulous from Jonathan Gold. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and he's here with me every week with a restaurant recommendation.
We are going to the new restaurant, Soto.
Soto must mean that it's underneath something else. Where is it?
It's underneath the restaurant that was Orlando Orsini for about 1,000 years and is going to be Ricardo Zarate's new restaurant any minute now.
And Soto was for a while better known as the Test Kitchen.
Right, the recital hall for chefs. I miss that place already.
And what is the cuisine?
The cuisine is Italian food, sort of specifically Southern Italian food, though they don't make a fetish of it.
So given that it focuses a bit on Southern Italian food, is there pizza involved?
There is pizza. The restaurant is built around an enormous, supposedly like 15,000-pound pizza oven made of, you know, brick and earth and whatever pizza ovens are made out of that has had all the materials, including the earth, supposedly shipped from Naples. Because really, if you don't have dirt from Mount Vesuvius, how can you even think of making a pizza? They're still at the beginning of the learning curve on pizza, I think. I mean, you know, you more than anyone else know that there's a definite learning curve to a pizza oven, that it can take a long time to figure out just how the heat works and what the great spots are and where the stuff is browned on top. But their pizza is pretty good so far. I suppose the crust is definitely Neapolitan style, which is, say, it's a little bit puffy, it's a little bit soft.
And the toppings, are they pretty traditional?
The toppings, I mean, you can, of course, get a, you know, marinara pizza, or you can get a margherita pizza, which are the only two things that you would conceivably get in Naples itself. But the one I really liked came with sort of really funky, nice homemade guanciale.
Yeah, guanciale being bacon, but from the cheek, not the belly.
Right. And it came with like little clumps of ricotta and with sautéed scallions that blistered a little bit from the heat, and a scattering of fennel pollen, which was unusual but really nice.
That sounds really good. So are they using this beautiful oven for other things besides pizza?
They are, as you would probably expect. You know, they do sort of chicken under a brick that you know, a lot of people are doing. They bake peppers. They bake meats.
Now, are the peppers stuffed?
They're not stuffed. They're just sort of, you know, blistered and charred. And there's some capers and oregano and a little bit of olive oil. And it's more of like antipasto kind of thing. Some other antipasti that I've never had anywhere else, something called a pitule, which they say comes from Puglia. I've never seen it in Puglia, but I believe that it exists. And it's sort of an appetizer donut. They're fritters that come drizzled with cooked wine, cooked down to a syrup.
Mosto.
Yeah. Again, with like clumps of the really good ricotta that they either have found a good place to buy or they make themselves.
Since I'm like an antipasti fetishist, one might say, what antipasti do they have?
There's a ton of them. The ones that I had that I really liked were the, you know, grilled sepia, the cuttlefish, which were really soft and really delicate, but, you know, took the flavor of the smoke and the flame just beautifully. They were served simply on a plate with a little bit of eggplant caponata and maybe some, I think maybe a sprinkling of orange zest.
Are they doing pastas?
They are doing pastas. Not so many of them, and they're different ones. There's something called casareche, which just means homemade, but it was this big sort of twisted pasta that came with an unusual ragu made with braised lamb that had the flavor of lamb, but was the consistency of a paste. And I guess they mix it with raw egg yolk and pecorino and toss it, so there's almost a carbonara consistency to it.
That's so interesting. It's like a lamb carbonara.
Right.
Oh, I love that idea.
And there was another one I liked a lot, which was fusilli that were obviously homemade, tinted, you know, jet black with squid ink and tossed with shaved botarga, the dried mullet roe, which has a really, you know, toasty and funky and fishy smack to it.
Yeah, very intense.
Nice. Really great with a glass of white wine.
Are they continuing the cocktail tradition at Sotto that was begun with Test Kitchen?
They are. I believe that Julian Cox, who's pops up mostly with John Sadler's places, is also at least designing the cocktail menus here. And there's a lot of Italian influenced things, a lot of Amari and everything, as you would expect.
Oh, that's nice. Amari being the herbal-based digestivos.
You know, very bitter, very sweet, very much the sort of flavor of the month in cocktail circles at the moment.
Yeah.
One other interesting thing about Sotto is that when you get there, instead of your bread with butter, bread with olive oil like everybody does, they bring out these big bruschetta made of homemade, sort of wheaty, healthy-tasting bread, spread with absolutely unhealthy-looking dollops of cured lard.
Wow. That, you know, I mean, they're going to stop doing that after a while because people will sate their appetites too easily.
Yeah, basically a quarter pound of pounded lard will take up a large portion of stomach room, I think.
Is it like the Italian style where it's strutto, where it's infused with like really great salt and spices?
Yes, definitely.
Mm, yeah.
It actually reminded me more of the stuff that you get in, you know, that famous butcher shop in Panzano.
Yeah.
Than anything I've had in southern Italy.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
We've been talking about Sotto on Pico near Beverly Drive. Get the exact address and a list of recommended dishes by texting the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to the number 69866. And don't forget to check out the Good Food Restaurant map for a complete list of all of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions. It's on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. Professional kitchens are full of chefs who represent lineages. Disciples and admirers, cooks go to do a stage or internship in a kitchen so they can receive intense training by doing from masters they admire. In this age-old system, techniques, recipes, and flavors are passed down and imbued with new life. El Bulli is the famed restaurant in Spain whose owner, Chef Ferran Adrià, has completely changed the language of cooking. Celebrated chefs René Redzepi of Noma, Grant Achatz of Alinea, José Andrés of Bazaar all had their culinary lives changed by their time at El Bulli. Time correspondent Lisa Aben started helping Ferran Adrià to put together a database of past stagiaires at El Bulli and ended up writing a book about those who choose to spend a season in the kitchen with Ferran Adrià and his staff. So, Lisa, how hard is it to get into do a stage with Ferran Adrià at El Bulli?
It's very difficult to get in. Ferran likes to say that it's harder to get a stage than it is to get a reservation. And if you know anything about El Bulli, you know that that's saying something. They get thousands of applications each year and end up accepting about 32. And of those, almost all of them, except for a small handful who come from some Catalan culinary schools, almost all of them have worked in some of the best restaurants around the world. So French Laundry, Tetsuya, Noma, Osteria Francescana.
And why Ferran Adrià? What is it that he has created that makes cooks and chefs so eager to spend time in his kitchen?
Well, I think Ferran is widely considered, not just by the general public, but more importantly, I think, by other chefs, the most influential chef of our time. He has dramatically reimagined what cooking can be. And so they come because, in part, yes, they want to learn the specific techniques and uses of different products that he's known for. But really, he represents a whole approach to cooking that's very attractive to a lot of young chefs.
So once they get there, what is their initial orientation like? Are they paid? What are they given?
Well, they are paid not a dime. Most of them will stay for the whole 6 months that the restaurant is open. And in exchange, they get a bed in a very crowded and to be honest, kind of grotty apartment. And some of these apartments, there were as many as 11 or 12 stagiaires living at a time. They get one meal a day, and that's it. Other than that, it's just the experience. Most of them, you know, they have to borrow money to be able to come to pay for the plane ticket and to live during the 6 months while they're there.
What is their initial orientation? You have this group of people from all over the world. What is the lingua franca of the kitchen?
Well, they will all speak Spanish, or they are at least supposed to come having with some knowledge of Spanish. In fact, many of the foreign ones do not, and that can have a significant impact on their future at El Bulli. If they can't speak Spanish, then they can't understand what the chefs are saying to them, and so they will often get put into positions of less responsibility, or they'll be put in what's called the small kitchen, where they'll be preparing family meal rather than the dishes that go out to guests. In terms of the orientation, the first day is quite, it's sort of, at this point, has its own legend built around it, because they'll spend the first day, you know, learning the basic rules and filling out a lot of paperwork. But then El Bulli has a longstanding tradition of having the new stagiaires clean the rocks outside the restaurant, the whole approach and parking area to up to El Bulli is sort of covered in these pieces of slate. And as you approach, most people don't notice this, but if you pay close attention, you'll notice in some cases that the rocks very neatly overlap each other. And that's because the first day of each season, all of the stagiaires go out there and spend about 5 hours removing each rock, cleaning around it, and putting it back in place.
So this must be fairly humbling for people who have come from some of the best restaurants in the world and who probably think of themselves as on their way up, if not already arrived.
It can be incredibly difficult for especially some of the older ones. Most of the stagiaires who come are in their early 20s, but there are people who come, you know, who are as much as 33, 34 years old, and they might have already attained a position elsewhere as sous chef or in even a few cases as chef de cuisine, and they can find it extremely difficult to sort of suppress their ego and to find themselves back shucking oysters 3 hours a day.
Do people ever go from being an intern to actually working there?
Yes, but not in the same year. I mean, there were two stagiaires in 2009, which is the year that I was there, who were promoted to chefs de partie, but they were still considered interns. So during that time, even though their responsibilities increased tremendously, they were not being paid. But in subsequent years, including in the 2009 group, there were several that then would come back the following year for a paid position.
And that's the only way that El Bulli could operate, really, and not lose more money than I imagine it probably has lost over every season it's been open, is by creating this food sort of on the back of all of these unpaid interns.
Exactly. I mean, it's not just a financial question. I mean, certainly that's true. If he didn't have this free labor source, he would never be able to afford to put out those kinds of dishes. But it's also, I think, really integral to his creative process because he needs this massive amount of labor to be able to create some of his most spectacular dishes. I mean, there's a risotto that he makes each year. The year that I was there, it was made from corn, which sounds normal enough until you see what they're doing. And instead of making it from individual kernels of corn, the risotto was made from the tiny piece of germ inside each kernel. And so you would have 15 or so stagiaires each day take about an hour to squeeze germ from the inside of individual kernels of corn. And it's a great dish. It's an inventive dish. It's a new way of making a risotto with this germ acting as an individual grain of rice. But he couldn't have thought of that, if he didn't have the security of knowing that there would be 15 pairs of hands there to squeeze out the germ.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for such a fascinating inside look from a very different point of view.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Lisa Abend's book is The Sorcerer's Apprentice. I'll be back in 1 minute with more good food. Jonathan Waxman is here, and we'll find out about Assyrian food. Stay tuned. Welcome back. You're listening to Good Food here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. We think of the consequences associated with being overweight or obese primarily as health concerns. But as America's waistline grows larger, we're no longer seeing the fallout strictly at the doctor's office. The United States Coast Guard has recently issued new rules for the weight capacity on commercial passenger vessels. Bill Peters is a naval architect who helped write the rule. He's here with details.
The assumed average weight per person that the rule has instituted is now 185 pounds per person. And this is increased by at least 25 pounds from the former weight that was used. The basis for that weight is taken from studies carried out by the National Center for Health Statistics in their National Health and Nutrition Evaluation Survey, or NHANES. In those surveys, the NCHS has taken information from the U.S. population and determined what the average weight of various segments of the U.S. population are. And we have used that information in order to come up with our new weight. One of the things that they were able to document in a report that they issued in 2004 is that the average weight of males and females in the U.S. population had increased by over 24 pounds since the early 1960s, which happens to be when the Coast Guard instituted its weight of 160 pounds. So as you can see, our use are going to 185 pounds tracks that change.
So on the vessels, has the maximum been listed as number of people or total weight?
The way the capacity has been issued to passenger vessels is by the number of persons. However, as we know, the actual way ship stability works is interested in total weight. And so when you have an increase in the assumed weight of all of the passengers, that can make an important and meaningful difference in what the total capacity in terms of numbers of people really is.
Now, you're a naval architect. Can you describe the types of stresses that occur on the ships themselves from sailing or cruising over the life of the ship overweight?
Well, it really doesn't come out to the idea of stresses per se, but the idea is that when a passenger vessel is loaded to its maximum capacity, where you have both the numbers of people as well as the maximum weight, you have the minimum margin of safety that you need to have in order that the vessel may safely complete its voyage without capsizing.
You know, it's interesting when I hear you speak about this and about the issues of safety, I think about airplanes. Will the FAA also be responding to this new information about the weight of our population?
As a matter of fact, they already have. The FAA issues what are called advisory circulars on a number of elements relating to commercial aircraft safety. One of these advisory circulars is called one on aircraft weight and balance control. And they issued a revision to that in 2005, which referred to the same NCHS data for assumed weight per person.
So when does the final rule come into effect?
The final rule that uses the 185 pounds comes into effect on December 1st, 2011.
It was such a simple idea. A, people tend to leave lots of fruit on their trees, whether they have a small orchard or a couple of backyard trees. And B, lots of people in LA County are hungry. Collect from A to feed B. And so Food Forward was born. Rick Namias is founder of Food Forward, and he's here to give us an update. Things are going full steam ahead for you guys, aren't they?
It's been amazing. Since I spoke with you, God, a year and a half ago, we've blossomed, and excuse the fruit puns, they just kind of come wild and furious, but we've blossomed in the amount of pounds that we've harvested, which is kind of our big bottom line, but also the number of volunteers that have gotten involved, ways people can be involved, and the geography in which we service.
So I gave just a little tease about what you do, but why don't you give a fuller explanation of what Food Forward does?
Well, that's it. It's an insanely simple concept, and the way you framed it is perfect. Basically, local fruit plus volunteers equals 100% to the hungry. That's our motto. I mean, basically, every pound we harvest goes to people in need. We have about a half dozen pantries, large and small, that we service. We will pick from one mature tree to an orchard of 300 or 400 trees, scale the pick accordingly. For example, we'll do a single tree with about 5 or 6 people. It could be a Sunday morning, could be a sunset pick in the afternoon after work. Or we'll do these large events with upwards of 150 people. Just this April, we had 17,000 pounds picked in 4 hours at the CSUN Orchard. And for us, just seeing this thing grow and seeing, I mean, unfortunately, the bottom line is the need's growing. Since I saw you, the need has doubled.
Give us an idea of how much fruit you picked last year.
Well, our first year was almost exactly 100,000 pounds, which in the world of food pantries, you'd kind of multiply by 4 because you go by servings of fruit. And that was 400,000 servings of fruit. At this point, cumulatively, we are now well beyond the 1.7 million servings of fresh fruit, which is well over 400,000 pounds and growing. I mean, what's been phenomenal is we've kind of started a small chapter in Moore Park, which is vital not only because they're this semi-rural environment, but the people who are in need there and who we service through Catholic Charities are often agriculture and farm workers, people who ironically pick the food for us cannot afford it, which to me is, as someone you know who's worked with farm workers for many years, is something that really gets me. And we have now a Girl Scout troop out in Burbank who is owned basically Burbank. They've set up relationships with two pantries, and these young ladies and their mothers get out and basically they're picking for us, and they're doing the work, and they're owning the neighborhood. So we've kind of, you know, we started with 4 core people that were all volunteer, and the way we've built this out now is in different neighborhoods where people want to get involved, and I invite listeners who are listening to us who are in Southern California who say, hey, I enjoy food and I understand the abundance equation, is people become neighborhood captains. They kind of become ambassadors or eyes and ears, and with a little bit of training, they kind of own a neighborhood, and we help connect them with volunteers and the labor and the tools.
How do you identify where the fruit is?
Your eyeballs. And I joke, but I'm really serious. The people who have been doing this with us from the very beginning have said to me, I now see oranges from about a half mile away. These little, you know, these little orange dots or yellow dots, if they're grapefruits, kind of just jump out at you against a blue sky from blocks and blocks away. And we've come to know that there are certain areas, like the North Valley, when you're dealing with the Northridge and they call it the Sherwood Forest area, where so many of the original 100-year-old legacy trees are still producing fruit. Whether we pick it or not, this stuff is coming in every year. And we've developed relationships where, for example, on Big Sunday, that great volunteer thing, is we now do an entire neighborhood. We send out about 10 pick leaders in one 2-block area, and we have about 100 people harvesting, and 4,000 or 5,000 pounds comes from this one 2-block area. For us, it's now a matter of getting the tools and the volunteers who get up in the trees and get high enough to glean everything, because even on a great pick, there's still a crown at the top that's 25 feet up that we can't safely access. We're kind of addressing that stuff now and hoping that some of the homeowners that work with us top off their trees. You know, they're actually taking more pride. I mean, they get a tax deduction for every pound we pick, but most people are doing it because they love it. What we've also started doing is a Can It program, which will start in June, which you will be part of, I'm so pleased to say. And that is being organized as both education and revenue generating. We're not an organization that wants to keep putting our hand out for money for grants. So one of the ways we are going to be doing this is teaching a 4-part quarterly workshop with each season's fruit coming directly in from Food Forward Harvest. Some of that fruit will be canned and then sold with, again, every dollar going back. And it's a very tight, hands-on experience that's being led at the Farmer's Kitchen in Hollywood.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Thank you.
Rick Namias runs Food Forward. Find out how you can get involved at kcrw.com/goodfood. Jonathan Waxman is chef owner of Barbuto in New York City. In the early days of his career, Jonathan worked at Chez Panisse in Berkeley and Michael's in Santa Monica, right at the beginning of the movement that eventually came to be called California cuisine. I know it's really hard to imagine a time when restaurants all over the country weren't cooking seasonally from the market, but Jonathan, one of California cuisine's pioneers, is credited with showing the East Coast what our California ethos could bring to serious cuisine when he opened his restaurant, Jams. Jams turned out to be a chapter for Jonathan, though, not the whole story. Through an interesting and circuitous path, Chef Waxman found his true culinary soul in the Italian kitchen. His new book is Italian My Way. Could you pick an ingredient or a dish that you think is emblematic of what you did at Jams and contrast it with something that you might use the same ingredients but give it a very different kind of spin at Barbuto?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the easiest example is the Jonathan Waxman chicken, or JW chicken as it's known now. And, you know, at Michael's, we did it with, we boned out the chicken and we grilled it over gas and we served it with frozen French fries and watercress. And then when I did it at Jams, it evolved to a mesquite grilled with a little tarragon butter and, you know, house-made French fries. Now we do it at Barbuto, where I leave the bones in. I still serve a half chicken, but we leave all the bones in, and we roast it in a wood-burning oven and serve it with salsa verde and nothing else. So I think that, you know, it sort of devolved itself from sort of more of a, you know, French bistro style to almost, you know, an Italian home-brewed style.
I know that part of the secret of that dish is basting, which you really believe in. Talk about basting for a minute and why you think it's so important.
Well, it's really funny. Yesterday I just did this little video with Caleb Followell from Kings of Leon, and he says, "Jonathan, how do you make that chicken so good?" And I said, you know, it's about all the basting. And everybody laughs at me about basting. But, you know, really it was one thing that stuck when I was in cooking school way back when at La Varenne in Paris in 1976. And Ferdinand Chambret said, you have to baste every 5 minutes. I thought he was nuts. But you know what? It's the only way to get that blistery, beautiful skin and to get that mahogany color and to get so the chicken just cooks perfectly from the inside out. And, you know, at home, it seems like a little bit of a pain, but it really isn't that hard. You could do it 10 minutes at home. You don't have to do every 5 minutes like we do at the restaurant.
So what were you doing with the Kings of Leon?
Well, Caleb, the lead singer, and I have become really good friends. In fact, he put a little notation on the back of the book. And he eats chicken like once a day, sometimes twice a day. So he said, "Jonathan, how do you make the chicken?" So I gave him a lesson yesterday. And, you know, and I made him baste it every 5 minutes, that chicken. And he's looking at me like I was out of my mind. But at the end, he goes, "Now I get it." You know, I always think that musicians and chefs are, you know, from the same guild.
Yeah, I think so, too. Especially when you're a chef who gets to the point where you're riffing all the time, where you have this huge base of knowledge. But then when you go to cook, sort of that all falls away. And then you're just left with the notes, which in our case is the ingredients.
Well, I think that's really sort of the essence of what we call California cuisine, that we're able as Californians to kind of draw on the vast, wonderful produce that we have there, but mainly from all the ethnicities that exist in California, you know, from Vietnamese to Mexican to Cambodian to Italian. I mean, we run the full gamut in California, and, you know, I think we're so lucky to have all these different, you know, sort of cultures in one small place, basically, and they all have access to ingredients. And then our job is kind of to look at them all, you know, amalgamate them, and then kind of have fun, improvise a little bit, make really interesting dishes.
But, and yet you're in New York, you have this restaurant in New York, you are for all purposes now a settled New Yorker. Do you still feel that there's a part of you that is this emissary from our state?
Well, you know, there's a part of my, you know, my brain that still is totally, you know, hard dialed into California. And, you know, I was just in Pebble Beach over the weekend doing the Pebble Beach Food and Wine Festival. And, you know, I'm just shocked by the ingredient difference, you know, that exists. I did a dinner in San Francisco and I got these little peas. I did dinner at an A16 restaurant and they got these peas for me and they're casual about them. You know, it's in the book. It's peas with pancetta and mint. Very simple dish, quintessentially Italian. But the peas were extraordinary. It made the whole dish. That's what I miss every day.
Yeah, we're really, really, really lucky. So with summer around the corner, I'm sure your mind is buzzing with ideas as, you know, that great triad of zucchini, eggplant, and tomatoes start to come into the markets. What are you making now, and what will you be making then?
You know, New York is an odd growing area. We only have 100 days of growing every year, and we don't plant really until May 1st because of the frost issues. So there really isn't anything in the market yet. We're getting little bits and pieces. We won't have true asparagus from Long Island until June. We won't get our real peas or fava beans until June. We won't get apricots and actually until July. So right now we're actually stealing from you guys from California or from Florida. So, you know, we want spring to happen. So what we do is we bring things in, which is not the most sustainable thing in the world. But, you know, that aside, so we're doing lots of things with peas, fava beans, spring onions, you know, baby carrots. Yeah, I remember I ate at the River Cafe in London 2 weeks ago, and everything I had was green. So I think it's the green period for cuisine, and I love it. Like, I made salsa verde with Caleb yesterday, and the salsa verde had spring onions, it had mint, it had spinach, it had arugula, it had you know, a little bit of parsley, and that was it, with the, you know, the garlic, anchovy, and capers in it. And he looked at me because this is the best thing I've ever eaten.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. The book is lovely.
Thank you.
Jonathan Waxman is the chef owner of Barbuto in New York City. His new book is Italian My Way. When Good Food returns, we'll taste some Assyrian food. What that is, next.
Hello, everybody. This is Eddie Lin with KCRW's Good Food, and I'm here today in Tarzana, California, at St. Mary's Parish. It's the Assyrian Food Festival. If you're anything like me, you don't know much about geography, and you know even less about ancient geography. The little I do know about Assyria is that it was an ancient kingdom centered on the upper Tigris River in what's known today as northern Iraq. And the descendants still live in the region today, and they form the Christian minority in Iraq. The food is pretty similar to Middle Eastern cuisines, but I'm going to have someone tell us more about the Assyrian culture and the food. Introduce yourself, please.
Hi, I'm Joseph Isavi, and I'm a former county commissioner on Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs Commission, the first Assyrian-American who was appointed to that position. Assyrian culture is a continuation of the cultures of Sumeria and Akkadia in the ancient Middle East called Mesopotamia. The Assyrians lost their empire 612 BC, I believe. And after that, they have been living as minorities over the greater Middle East. The Assyrian Empire at one point stretched from Elam and western Persia all the way to Egypt, included Iraq, Turkey, Jordan, Syria. And today, of course, there is no longer an Assyrian country named Assyria, but the descendants of those Assyrians still basically carry a proud tradition of Christ's language. The Aramaic language, which was spoken by Christ, is still spoken today by the Assyrians all over the world.
From what I understand about Assyrian food, it's pretty similar to Middle Eastern food. So what can you tell me differentiates Assyrian cuisine from the rest of the Middle Eastern or Mediterranean cuisines?
Because all the cultures in that area have been interacting for so many centuries, a lot of the food is just different, what you call additions and subtractions of different ingredients. But basically, if you say, for example, dolma is used by the Assyrians today, by the Greeks, by the Lebanese, and it's a sort of a universal food. But the Assyrian way of making dolma, of course, is a little different than the others. We have foods that were brought from Russia, so Assyrians adopted those food like borscht, which is very popular with Eastern Europeans as well as the Russian former Soviet republics. You have kebab, you have Assyrian bread, which is an ancient bread. It's called lavash. Now, lavash was taken by other cultures, adopted by other cultures as their own, but it, of course, comes from Assyrian origins. Beer was found mistakenly by an accident in Assyria a few thousand years ago, where a few pieces of bread were left in a jar of water and they fermented. That's how beer became known all over the world. We eat a lot of rice and different kinds of khurush, we call them. Khurush are these goulash type soups. Iranian Assyrians, they love qorma sabzi, which is something from the Persian heritage. In Iraq, Assyrians make kubba and foods that are based on the Arab interactions. So the rack of lamb and chicken kebab and lamb kebab and shashliks, all these things are basically, no culture in Middle East can claim them just as their own. But I believe a lot of them came from the origins of the Assyrian heritage.
I heard a lot about the alcoholic beverage called arak. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes. Arak is basically distilled alcohol. Usually it's used out of raisins or, grapes. But, arak is used extensively in those areas.
Now, is there a large Assyrian community in the valley or Tarzana?
Yes, the Assyrian community, well, compared to the other communities, it's not very large, but we have probably about between 10 to 15,000 Assyrians living in the Southland.
This is Eddie Lin with KCRW's Good Food.
Pictures from the Assyrian Food Festival are at kcrw.com/goodfood. You've been listening to Good Food here on KCRW. If you missed any part of today's show, don't worry. You can download the podcast at kcrw.com or listen on demand on KCRW's app for the iPhone or Android. And join the Good Food community on Facebook. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. Good Food's produced and edited by Harriet Ells with Jillian Ferguson, Candace Moyer, and Laurel Garcia. Ronnie Mickelson mixes the show, and Gary Masiha chooses our muse. Thanks so much to Becky Nelson. I'm Evan Kleiman. See you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.